Tonight on the Daily Debrief, the state accuses an NFL owner's attorneys of lying to a judge. Is it a flag on the play or not? Plus,
I could do a controlled removal of the bodies.
Police struggle to describe the aftermath of a Vermont crash which killed five teens. Did the defendant know exactly what he did wrong?
He went to get off from the ground and take off again.
Also, the legal fight escalates between the Attorney General and Congress. This is the Daily Debrief. It's Wednesday, May 8th. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Aaron Keller, along with Bob Hilla and Linda Kenny-Bodden. Florida prosecutors are accusing the legal team of NFL owner Robert Kraft of lying to a judge. Now the prosecutors want the defense team held in contempt. The accusations unfolded after a hearing over whether Florida authorities violated the Constitution when they recorded men receiving sexual massages inside a spa. Court documents allege that the defense threatened to release a tape of the testifying officer threatening to make up a reason to pull over one of the suspects. Here is how that officer's actual in-court testimony unfolded.
The body cam also picks up audio, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And for whatever reason, I'm asking you, do you recall saying it doesn't matter in response to that? I can make some up.
You said this, that I said that during the Robert Kraft traffic?
No. Right, this traffic stop right before that. The traffic stop right before that when your audio was on, before you ever knew you were going to stop, Mr. Kraft.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't remember saying that.
Okay.
And I if I said it, I wouldn't even know the context of how it was said, and obviously in more of a joke with however you heard that.
Okay. So
that was said.
Okay. So whether it was a joke or not, you don't have
I don't have a recollection of it, so I'm not going to tell you that who I was talking to or whatever. I have zero recollection that I said that.
Right. But you're also not saying under oath, of course,
well,
that you're 100%
sure. You probably have something where you're going to come back.
Wait a minute. The question was, do you recall? His answer is, no, he does not.
And then the final question is, while you may not specifically recall it, what you're not saying under oath is that there's no chance you said that, correct?
No, I wouldn't want to do that because you may come back. I don't remember saying anything like that. If I said something like that tongue in cheek or in a goofy manner, which obviously looks terrible now, respectfully, I don't remember saying that.
Here is what the state is arguing in seeking contempt charges against the defense. A review of the radio transmissions and the body-worn camera video conclusively show that Officer Kimbark never made the inflammatory remark. Both attorneys Speary and Burke represented to the court that they had watched the body camera tape and heard this comment allegedly made during a previous stop. Either the assertion that they had reviewed the tape was untrue or their representation of what occurred during the tape was untrue. That is from the state's motion. The defense responded to Law and Crime last night saying the state's motion is an act of desperation. They know what they filed is false and misleading to the court, but they did it anyway because they are desperate. That's because they want to deflect attention away from their illegal and unconstitutional methods in investigating and prosecuting the case. It's pathetic. That response is from Kraft attorney William Burke, who also added that his performance has been vigorous and ethical. I want to bring Bob Hilla and Linda Kenny-Bodden in right away here. So, Linda, let me start with you. This cop was rather cocky on the stand.
Right.
If he did say he was going to make stuff up, then again, what is the context? Was he just being his snarky self saying, oh, I understand what you're saying. You want me to track the suspect down and then find a traffic reason to pull him over. Yeah, make some stuff up, and that's why we're going to pull him over. Or does he really mean he literally will make up evidence?
Well, that's the issue, Aaron. You hit on the point. He said, come up with something. That's what's on the tape, talking about the prior stop. So what Alex Speier is trying to do is saying, well, that doesn't really mean that. That means you're really going to make some dog doo-doo, as I call it, dog emoji up, right? Dog doo-doo emoji. That's what Alex is trying to say. But what the prosecutor saying is that he represented it to the court as if that's what he said specifically, not that it was an inferential conclusion you could draw through a cross-examination.
Okay, Bob, so just minutes ago, basically, within the last hour or so, The defense filed a response to this, basically accusing the prosecution of misrepresenting all this. So each side is accusing the other side of lying. How does it end?
Well, it ends because the issue really is on contempt, especially here in the courtroom. Was there an order or direction from the court that the lawyer violated? And there was none. It's just really an issue of the scope of permissible probing in a suppression hearing, and whether or not the suggestions to the officer amounted to a misrepresentation of fact to the court, but it wasn't in violation of anything that the court said not to do.
So is it inaccurate to even call it contempt?
I think it is.
Wow.
Well,
interesting.
It could be the court could still use its powers and say, hey, you misled me. I'm revoking your pro hoc vici because these are out-of-state attorneys in Florida. And when you're out of state, you got to be up here. You can't be in the gutter down here.
Wow. This is going to get nasty, or I should say continue to be nasty, because it's already hit that point. Now to the case of horror on the highway. A Vermont man is accused of speeding the wrong way down an interstate and slamming into a car carrying five high school students. Stephen Burgoyne is on trial facing five counts of second-degree murder, one count of aggravated operation, and one count of gross negligence. The victims of that massive fiery crash were all 15 and 16 years old. None of them survived. And here's where it gets even more shocking. After the first crash, Burgoyne stole a responding police car, took off, turned around, and then caused a second crash. Today in court, a retired state trooper described the difficult task of cleaning up the scene.
The fire department and the police officers that were there were unable to decide how to remove the victim's bodies from the car.
Okay. And what decision was made about how best to do that?
I had asked that the vehicle be brought to the state police office. There was a lot in the back that I could do controlled removal of the bodies in a location that was off the interstate with lighting. So the driver was Cyrus, I don't know how he says his name.
Cyrus.
And behind him was Liam. And then Mary Harris was the center passenger that had been ejected. Eli was in the back seat, back passenger side seat, and then in the front was Janie.
A medical examiner testified that none of the victims appeared to have died from the fire. They all died from the impact. Here is that medical examiner's opinion as to one of them.
Final autopsy for Eli Brookins. Did you determine the age of Mr. Brookins at the time of his death?
He was 16 years old.
Did you observe fatal injuries to Mr. Brookins?
Yes.
What were they?
Those were blunt injuries, skull fractures, injuries of the brain, and injuries of the torso.
And how were those injuries caused?
From blunt force trauma.
And were you able to determine a manner of death for Mr. Brookins?
Yes.
What was that?
Homicide.
And were the injuries from the collision or the resulting fire the sole cause of his death?
Yes.
Again, all of those victims died from similar causes and injuries. Graphic dashcam video showed the aftermath of the deadly crashes. Law and Crime's Rachel Stockman takes us through what the videos show.
After Stephen Burgoyne struck a car full of five teenagers driving the wrong way down the highway in Vermont, he was not done. Dashcam video shows Burgoyne stealing a police cruiser and fleeing the scene. In this portion, we've sped up for clarity. He stops, does a three-point turn, and drives back to the scene of the first crash. This video stops just before he causes a second massive crash. Eyewitnesses Keith Porter described leaping out of the way to avoid being hit by Burgoyne.
I expected to not survive. And I laid down on the highway and kind of tried to dive towards the median and brace myself.
Porter escaped with minor injuries. The jury next saw a dash cam video of the fiery wreckage of the second crash. Eyewitness Susan James described how the normally peaceful evening in the Vermont countryside transformed in an instant.
I mean, it looked like a war zone. It looked like an Armageddon. It looked like, you know, things had blown up.
Finally, the dash cam shows Burgoyne being treated by a doctor on the scene. Here, he even tries to escape. Burgoyne is finally detained and taken away handcuffed to a stretcher. This is Rachel Stockman reporting for the Long Crime Network.
Again, the defense admits the acts. The big question is whether Burgoyne was legally insane. There's evidence on both sides of that argument.
This trial is about why it happened.
During opening statements, Stephen Burgoyne's defense said Burgoyne had a history of mental health treatment, which points to insanity.
The evidence will be that Stephen Burgoyne was totally psychotic and delusional at the time of the crash.
But one witness for the state said Burgoyne talked to him after the first crash.
He just says, I don't know what happened, I just lost control, in kind of that cadence.
Burgoyne did not speak to the police after the second crash.
I asked him if he was involved in the crash.
Did he respond to you?
No.
The defense says he doesn't remember any of it.
Days later, he's confused, paranoid. He doesn't know why there's guards in the room.
But one responding officer and a nurse both said Burgoyne tried to flee as he was being treated for severe injuries.
The doctor asked if I could take the handcuffs off because he said it was making it hard for him to breathe.
How did Mr. Burgoyne respond to having his handcuffs taken off?
He attempted to get up.
When they took the handcuffs off, he went to get off from the ground and take off again. He tried to leave the to get away.
He did a quick spin, and I think he got up to maybe his knee, but then I was able to get him back onto the ground and put him back in handcuffs again.
I said, I am not going to be helping with this because I didn't know what he was capable of doing.
The statement and the flight attempt could be the state's best evidence that Burgoyne lacked the adequate capacity to appreciate that his conduct was criminal. That is half of Vermont's insanity defense. But the jury could still find him insane by determining that he could not conform his conduct to the law.
Back again now are Bob Hilla and attorney Linda Kenny Bodden. Both attorneys, sorry, I don't need to take your title away, Bob. I'm one step ahead of myself again. So, okay, you're both nodding with my analysis there. I'm sitting here with my little chart and saying there's evidence that he's legally insane and evidence that he was legally sane. You know, he was wearing his seatbelt when he was involved in these crashes, or else he probably would have been dead too. That came out today. So, you know, he buckles up, and then when he's on the stretcher, he tries to flee. And he also makes that statement that he lost control. Now, are these signs that he was sane? I think that it hedges that he was. Linda, are you disagreeing with
me?
No,
I think that signs that he's sane. I think despite the lower burden of proof, I think there's no doubt he has a mental disease or defect. He needed treatment. He needed to be in hospital. However, you know, he puts on a seatbelt. He knows what a car key is. He obviously probably knows what a phone is. He drives a wheel. He knows what a wheel is. It's not like he's looking at these things and seeing chocolate chips.
Okay, so, you know, I said that, you know, it's going to be hard for him to get over the first part of the test there that we had up on the screen. But the second part, you know, could he conform his conduct to the law? Bob.
That I don't know. But I have to say here that these acts were rational. Cumulatively, they suggest that he was acting rational during the entire episode.
Yeah, I'm sensing a very difficult trick here for the jury, or a difficult decision, I should say, for the jury to try to figure this out. Because, you know, evidence that he's legally insane, prior treatments. He had a trip to the hospital not long before this crash. That he was smashing his cell phone on a rock. He was wandering in the forest and in the farm field. This is what the defense said during openings. And that he has no memory of what happened. Is that some evidence, Linda, that we could get at here and say, okay, you know, that adds up in the defendant's favor.
And that will be contradicted by, he said, he was asked at the scene, do you remember? I remember it all. I remember every minute. That contradicts that, what he said at the scene at the time. So I think the defense has a hard row. I think that obviously he needed treatment. Obviously there was a problem that they released him from the hospital. They didn't take him in. Those are other issues. And broken brain disease is a real big issue here.
Bob, final thought.
Remember, mental illness is not a defense. Insanity is a legal defense. And just because he was disturbed doesn't mean he's innocent of this crime.
That's always important to remember. We'll be back with you both here at the end of the broadcast, because still ahead tonight on The Debrief, the House of Representatives deciding just moments ago to hold the Attorney General of the United States in contempt. Plus, we're going to go back inside the courtroom for the McStay family murder case in California, where the jury had the chance to look over a key piece of evidence today. The House Judiciary Committee late this afternoon voted to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress. The Democrat-controlled House wants to see the full, unredacted Mueller report into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Both the Attorney General and the White House have refused to hand it over, citing executive privilege. Former federal prosecutor Gene Rossi spoke to Law and Crime's Bob Bianchi about what happens next.
Very rarely, the Congress can send out the bloodhounds and have the Attorney General arrested and brought to testify. Yeah,
that'll lead to a firefight in the streets.
Oh, no, I'm just telling you legally, academically. Of course, that will never be done. It's been done maybe once in the last 150 years. Option two is they make a referral criminally to the Department of Justice. That's going nowhere.
Right.
Number three, they file a civil action getting the court to decide the jump ball. They did that against Eric Holder. They held him in contempt. Civilly, they got a judge to rule that he had to turn over or provide information regarding Operation Fast.
That took years.
So, but they could try to ask the court in the third option to do an expedited review of the matter.
And now to a setback in the case of the McStay family murders. Defendant Charles Merritt is accused of killing business associate Joseph McStay and the entire McStay family in 2010. The graves of all four of the McStays turned up in the Mojave Desert in 2013. Due to ongoing issues with the health of an attorney, the case is now on hold yet again until May 21st. The defense this week asked the lead case agent whether authorities were sure that alternate suspect Dan Kavanaugh was really in Hawaii or whether that alibi was a lie. Here, the defense asks about a search warrant for Kavanaugh's phone records, which showed calls to Hawaii around the time the McStays disappeared and were likely killed.
Other than checking with Detective Avila, what else did you do to confirm Mr. Kavanaugh's alibi?
Are you talking later after we interviewed him?
Whenever.
We followed up with Laura Knowles, who was the female that he was in Hawaii with.
And you mentioned that on Friday, right?
Thursday.
Thursday.
Yes.
Okay. But did you ask her for any boarding passes or plane tickets or anything like that?
I actually asked and answered on Thursday.
Ooh. You'd have to talk to Detective Henke about that. He was the one that interviewed her.
Okay. Well, you're the case agent. Did you ever come across a ticket or a boarding pass or anything like that?
Not to my knowledge.
And you yourself never contacted any airline or any airport authority or the TSA or anything like that?
I did not.
Okay. So, Lauren Knowles' girlfriend, anything else that you did to check the alibi?
Obtained his phone records.
Okay. Now, again, I asked you on Thursday, what is it about his phone records that would provide an alibi for him?
Based on the fact that he says he's there, his phone records indicate that he's calling local establishments there in Hawaii, along with Lauren Knowles' statement and photographs that she provided. We're pretty confident that he was in Hawaii at the time that the McStays went missing.
So his phone records show calls to Hawaii numbers. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so, yes.
So would that require Mr. Kavanaugh to be in Hawaii to make calls to Hawaii numbers?
He asked me that on Thursday. I said no, it wouldn't.
Okay. So other than check his phone records, did you do anything else?
Not that I can recall offhand, no. Okay.
The question for the jury is whether that evidence is enough. Remember, the defense has IP addresses which suggest Kavanaugh was in California near where the murders happened when they happened. Next, the defense asked the lead investigator why he did not confront Kavanaugh about his financial moves related to the McStay business.
So the topic of Mr. Kavanaugh selling the company, did that come up in your interview?
It did.
Okay. Now, since you had information, since you knew that that was Joseph's company at the time that you interviewed Mr. Kavanaugh, did you ever confront Mr. Kavanaugh in this interview and say, how the heck did you sell Joseph's company
objection
without his permission?
Relevance, argumentative.
Sustain this, please.
Did you ever ask Mr. Kavanaugh, how was it that he was able to sell Joseph's company without Joseph's or his family's permission?
Objection, relevance.
Based on the information that's in there, at that portion of there, it didn't look like we confronted him regarding that. there were a lot of questions, obviously, because we had never talked to Mr. Kavanaugh before. So without speaking to Mr. Kavanaugh at that point, we still hadn't even spoke to Mr. Merritt. So Mr. Kavanaugh obviously provided information that Merritt deleted the accounts also that he felt was concerning.
Objection, not responsive. Move to strike.
So you didn't confront him, at least with, in what you're looking at in the transcript, correct?
In the portions of the transcript that are reviewed, no. Okay.
And do you recall ever going back after September 20th at any time and asking Mr. Kavanaugh, how is it that you were able to sell EIP without Joseph's permission or his estate's permission?
Objection, relevance, and argumentative.
I didn't re-interview Mr. Kavanaugh after that.
Okay, back now to Bob Hilla and Linda Kenny Bodden here. So, Linda, the jury went on a view of the defendant's truck. This is key because the state thinks they've got cameras that show the defendant's truck in the area of the victim's home around the time the victim's disappeared. But is it really his truck, and what's the jury looking for?
I was wondering that, too. What are they looking for? And if I were the defense, I'd be very concerned about that because the state is saying that's the truck. So after 10 years, I don't know what they could be looking for, Aaron. I wouldn't have. If I were the judge, I'd be like, overruled. No, you're not doing it. Sit down.
And, Bob, you're copiously taking notes during that exchange we just played. What's your reaction?
My reaction is that there are a lot of questions here about the inadequacy of the focus on Kavanaugh to rule him out as a suspect.
So, in other words, this is shoddy police work.
There's a question over who was in control of this investigation. It looks like people were all doing things in different directions, and they centered on Merritt from the start, and then they were really just trying to rule out rather than focus on whether it was Merritt or someone else.
Yeah, we've got this alternate suspect. Of course, where is he?
Where is he?
We are wondering, do you try to put him on the stand even if you can find him?
This is where you have the Minority Report, the movie. We should have had him chipped because if you can't find him, then if he came in, right, he's going to take the Fifth Amendment. But if the defense brings him in just so the jury can see him, I mean, that would be really interesting. But now, if you can't find him, isn't he an unavailable witness that you could read a statement for hearsay purposes?
We just had a big evidence argument about this, and we're not settled with it, so we'll have a lot more to talk about as this case rolls along. Bob Hilla, appreciate your insight. Linda Kenny Bodden, as always, we will continue to argue about this one long after we sign off because it is that time. We appreciate you watching The Debrief tonight. You can join us tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern for our recap of the best moments in cases nationwide. We'll see you tomorrow. Good night.